Welcome to Temple of Health Radio Show. This is Dr. Susan Kalb, and today I'm pleased to have back as my guest Dr. Joe Gallenberger, who is a clinical psychologist and a senior trainer at the Monroe Institute. If you look back in the archives of Temple of Health, we've interviewed him on his book, Liquid Luck, The Good Fortune Handbook. And he also has a book, Inner Vagus, Creating Miracles, Abundance, and Health. This book is, on a more personal note, however, the name of the book is Heaven is for Healing, A Soul's Journey After Suicide. Joe had a brother commit suicide, and with some of the very unique tools available through the Monroe Institute and the help of a channeler named Pam, he has put together a book to tackle one of the more difficult problems, which is how do we incorporate and even understand suicide and its effect on both the deceased and the people that they leave behind. Thanks for joining us, Joseph.
You're welcome, Susan. Are you having a good day over there?
Yeah, so far. It seems to be very nice out. Yeah. Would you like to give a little bit of your background to the listening audience before we get started?
Sure. I was trained as a clinical psychologist, worked a psychotherapy practice for about 30 years, and I've been a trainer at Monroe Institute in Virginia, which is a great place to go and explore consciousness with and your own sense of big questions and meaning in life without any dogma. And they use a special technology called HemiSync that allows people to slap on some headphones, listen to some tones, and enter very deep meditative states with, even if they've never had any meditation experience. So that's kind of the professional background.
Well, before we get started, I wanted to share with the listeners something that happened to me about 2 weeks ago. And I think it will, I guess, be a segue introduction into your story about your brother. I was walking in Kohl's. I had to go there late at night because of my busy schedule, and I had like $30 in Kohl's bucks that I had to spend. You know how that goes. You have to spend it or you lose it. So I was at the Kohl's, and there was hardly anybody in the store, and I was walking toward the back where the kitchen stuff is, and an entire set of china fell to the ground and crashed. I mean, it just crashed, and it was like nobody around. So I went over, and a manager came up, and I said, "Does this happen a lot?" He said, "Well, it's been happening around here lately." I said, "Well, I think I know why." So I went into my, you know, altered state of consciousness, and I found that there was somebody who was trying to get my attention, obviously. And so I invited her to go back in the car with me, and I called my friend who's a Christian shaman to, you know, just to confirm. I said, "Find out what you can." And then my roommate also has these abilities. I said, "Find out what you can." Between the three of us, we found out that 95 years ago, she was engaged, and she wanted to bring attention to herself, but she didn't want to kill herself. But as sometimes happens, she did kill herself accidentally. And that can happen in teenage suicides, as you know, as a therapist. And that's particularly tragic because it's a call for help. It's not really they don't really mean to die. But in any case, she wanted to go through transition. A lot of the spirits that are on the earth plane now are suicides, homicides, and other violent crimes, even car accidents, people ripped away early. And you go into this in your book. That's why I wanted to mention it. But she wanted me to bring her back here, and Fred opened up a portal in the parking lot like he usually does. He does it almost every Sunday because we do a lot of soul rescue here. And then she transitioned. But before she did, she visited with me. She said that she was almost my sister, which was interesting. You know, she had, even though she hadn't transitioned yet, there was a plan in place for her to be my sister, but then that didn't work out. And that we knew each other very well. And so we spent some time visiting before she went to the light. But it's just a point that, you know, even though my life has not been touched by suicide, somebody close to me had enough psychic energy to knock a place setting off a top shelf at Kohl's to get my attention.
That's a pretty interesting story, Susan.
It really is, isn't it?
Yeah.
Anyway, so obviously it does bring up the point that people who commit suicide often don't go into the light. And would you like to address?
Tell
your story first about,
sure,
you know, what you've been through with your brother and everything. But I think these are important things to understand. These people suffer a great deal longer than just the average person dying.
Well, first I'd say suicide covers a large area, from I have 2 weeks to live in terminal cancer pain, check out early, to we unfortunately had an 8-year-old commit suicide in the United States last week after being bullied.
Fairly impulsive
act.
Right.
And then there's many, many people who have battled grinding depression, chronic pain, setbacks in jobs, relationships for decades, and they finally just get so tired and their ego function gets so distorted they feel like the world would be better off without them and they don't have value, those kind of things. In my experience, it's, you know, we are definitely not encouraging suicide. There's a suicide hotline I like to mention, 1-800-273-8255. That's the national number. Whenever I've called there, somebody's answered first ring and has been very helpful as I tested out the line. My experience is such that when my brother passed, the first thing he sent was a street sign with a gavel and a line through it indicating no judgment. And he was so relieved not to be judged and condemned to hell. That said, there's great waves of compassion that greet you, great help available when you die, regardless of how you die. And with suicide, they may have some extra challenges on the other side in terms of the helpers. Might even put you in more of a deep sleep coma state and work unconsciously with you for a good while. But eventually, as you rise to some level of consciousness, while being held in great love, you do need to look at what would have gone in life if you stayed, some of the potential pain you caused people who stayed and remain in earth plane as your relatives and friends who loved you, and begin an education process about where things went wrong, what you might need to learn more about. For my brother, I think he didn't feel deserving of good things coming to him, and not a very good estimator of the power of his own light, if you will. So he died in Vegas, gunshot to the head. We in North Carolina just put a 1-inch obituary in the Vegas paper, and even grocery store clerks and bank tellers took the time to find us on the East Coast and write us how much he meant to them. He was a very kind and wonderful guy. So that's the kind of context, you know. When we go over, best I can tell, all death leads to light. Every experience and all our experiences are treasured. And there is no judgment by some external, you know, king-like God condemning us. But we do continue to have to face and learn more and more about love and light and how to do more and more beautifully on this planet. Does that make sense?
Edgar Cayce talked about overlays. Are you familiar with those?
I know Edgar Cayce, the term. You better define it for me and maybe then the audience too.
It's a great way not to judge people. Edgar Cayce said that when the soul planned their life, they would often have an overlay. He gave two examples. He said sometimes somebody's destined to be, say, president of the United States, and they'll be given an overlay of ambition because without it, they're not going to get there. They're not really an ambitious person, but they put on the coat of ambition to get to their goal because that's their life plan. And then say somebody really wonderful, really someone like your brother who comes in and has everything going for them but then gets an overlay of alcoholism. It's actually an overlay. It's a planned thing. And I wonder sometimes when I was reading, I was wondering if your brother had an overlay of this, you know, lack of self-confidence or, you know, lack of self-love as an overlay to, you know, kind of a test to see if you could swim with weights on. And
yeah,
it's just
very mysterious. What I would say, I originally wrote a book called Brothers Forever After He Died.
Mm-hmm.
Quite quickly, and then this book, Heaven is for Healing, is taking up 25 years later. What has he been doing on the other side for that amount of time, and how it's affected my life over that time. And within that, really learning that we don't have any idea consciously, usually, about all of our missions and what success is, real success is, and what failure is. What I mean by that is it seemed like he came into this life that I knew him in not believing love was real and left mm-hmm. feeling love was real.
Mm-hmm.
And on a spiritual basis, that's a great achievement. So it can look objectively like, gee, this fella, you know, had a really hard time here and didn't succeed in mission, but we have no idea what the mission is sometimes. My mom could do New York Times crossword puzzle in ink. Her main fear as she got older was to get in a rest home because she had lost her memory, and that's what happened, you know, so she had Alzheimer's. And when she died, I said, Mom, what's up with that? That seemed to be the thing you wanted least. And she said, well, I couldn't figure any other way to get rid of all my religious guilt. Your dad and I had been married 64 years, and it gave him a couple years to learn how to cook and clean and make new friends and adjust the things before my death because he still had plenty to do here. Another example maybe where there's an elegant spiritual plan, but we don't have much of an idea of it when we're here in the physical.
Yeah, I've had a couple of experiences with friends of mine who've tried to commit suicide, taken obviously way overdose of pills. You know, the combination of pills they took and the number of pills they took would have killed anybody. But on even those several occasions they tried to commit suicide, nothing happened. They checked into a hotel room, took all the pills, and then woke up the next morning feeling, you know, a little groggy, but not bad at all. And that is showing me that if you're not supposed to commit suicide, now probably with a gun that's different, but if you're not supposed to commit suicide, even the intent to do so may be bypassed, and probably what it is, the pills just aren't absorbed. You know, they probably go straight through without being absorbed.
Well, I'd be, I think, you know, there's divine interventions, but I sure wouldn't want to put out a message. I
wouldn't recommend that. No.
Go ahead and try, because if you're not supposed to, you'll be prevented.
Well, no, these people, the people I'm talking about intended to kill themselves.
Right, that's what I understand.
I mean, took all the
yeah.
things, I mean, did everything, like what your brother did, you know, did all the prearrangements, you know, they intended to die. But
right.
the point is that there is something beyond our will here that can interfere. And
perhaps can, yes.
Doesn't always, but can.
You know, because our free choice is really, in my opinion, very respected. We're free to drive tired and perhaps run over a child because we weren't paying attention. We're free to, you know, get addicted to medications or alcohol or to catch it as it starts to look like a problem and go for help and avoid the problem. And my experiences are the respect for our freedom is so great that, you know, even the way we choose death might be not something that was desirable, but as free beings, we're either free or we're not free. And that said, some things, you know, come in often in funny ways to protect us. You know, it can be you get a flat tire so you're not in a car accident that day. Mm-hmm. So I don't pretend to try to say, boy, I've figured out all the mysteries of life within this. But I do see, as a culture, this is one of the main reasons I wrote the book, we have such a dark idea about suicide, mm-hmm. going to hell for all eternity in the old traditional Catholic type of belief, to New Age beliefs where, oh, suicide is a real bad thing and you're going to have to come back and do exactly the same life over again, even harder. There's all this punishment associated with it. And in my experience, you're loved and you're treasured, and whatever decisions you do make in your freedom to choose, then other side is very willing to help and not judge. But it can be more challenging to help you after certain of your actions than others, if you will.
Well, let me tell you another brief story that happened in my family. I got a phone call one day. I have a relative who is very well-known scientist, very successful, not having any history of depression. He was giving a talk at Oxford, and he called me up because he had an overwhelming desire to kill himself, and he didn't know why. So he was guided to call me, and of course I asked about it, and I said, well, you killed yourself in that very room that you're in right now. Isn't that interesting? And I said, and your job now is to overcome that, to just get through it. Just use your will and get through it. And he did. I mean, he did. And he's not suicidal. He's not depressed. I mean, there was just that one instance when he was in that energy in the same physical location where he had to really dig deep into everything he had to not kill himself.
Interesting.
Now, that's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. You have an interesting family there.
You might have to get through something in your next life, you know.
It can be, best I can tell, again, with this variety of suicides, you're met with various different healing techniques, but eventually do have this type of life review that you might view as being sitting in a movie theater while your hand is very compassionately held and you see the play out of your life if you get chosen differently at many critical points, including the exit point. And then eventually getting to a place where, and it took my brother about 20 years on the other side to be considering another incarnation. Mm-hmm. And one thing that surprised me is they said with suicide and other very unpleasant lives, often there's a strong reluctance to come back, and they can offer people what we might call virtual lives, or almost like a lucid dream, very vivid, but that the person has the life experience without having to come into a physical body. Mm-hmm. And in those situations, it seems that they're more aware of their deeper soul nature and more aware of the help around them. And they're saying when you come into a physical body, it's very challenging because of the issues are encoded into your very DNA and your family's tribe DNA, if you will. So, in fact, it looks like he's going to choose one of these non-physical lives first, as almost what he calls Olympic training, to be a little more prepared for the kind of things that go on here in the physical. As we get to be a more experienced or older souls or something, it seems then that we can handle more of the darkness and density and confusion here and make something positive out of it. Even like me writing the book might be an example of transforming all that grief into the desire to help other people. But everybody's at a different place with it. And my own work in past life regression and stuff, you know, kind of convinces me that I can identify somewhere made kind of stupid decisions even about what the next incarnation would be like, and it didn't go well, and then popping back out and learning and having learned something, even though it was not pleasant, and then doing better the time after that.
There is a technology. I actually interviewed the author that that created the technology. He was a psychologist. It's a technology that takes you one step beyond EMDR for post-traumatic stress disorder and then puts you into something called induced afterlife communication. And so you take someone who's grieving and go through these eye movement things and then do one more step, and even if they're an atheist, they can communicate with the person who's deceased. And often that's very useful. I mean, obviously there's a lot of information that sometimes we need, like where wills are, where certain things are that were hidden. But also that the person is okay. You know, say if a child dies, it's very important that the parent know the child's okay and is doing well and what the reasons for death were and what the whole thing was about. But it can be very, very healing for people who are in grief.
Mm-hmm.
And as I said, you don't even have to believe in it for it to work, which is nice.
Yeah, it's... I personally think the veils are kind of thinning.
They are now.
With the meditation techniques that we use up in Monroe, being a trainer there 25 years ago, the effort that would be needed to get people to get into proper states for very deep meditative experiences, including being in touch with the other side, mm-hmm. were much more extensive than they seem to be now. Other lives and things seem to be, you know, and this is, of course, a sub-part of the population who are interested in this, but they seem to be more easy to be in touch there. You know, my feeling is love can pierce any veil, and, you know, that's my affirmation. If it's the veil we put over our heart to be protecting ourselves from further hurt, the veil between here and the other side, that with a few things that we can understand, like, you know, love is priceless, fear is expensive, choose wisely.
And also, when you really do realize that, like your brother said, you know, the body stays on the physical plane, but there is really continuity of consciousness. I mean, a lot of people don't even know they're dead. And I've experienced this in the hospital where someone attaches and is arguing with me, and I tell them they're dead, and they're arguing with me, but I know they're dead. But they died in the ICU after a head trauma in a car accident. They don't, you know, they have no conception of even what happened to them or memory of what happened to them. And I spent a lot of time in the hospital because I covered 6 emergency rooms. So obviously whenever a spirit would attach, it would be like something right behind you. It would be like it was always on my right side, and it was almost like someone was right there, and it was uncomfortable because, even if a physical being was right there, it would be uncomfortable because they're really in your space. So I couldn't usually get rid of them myself. I would have to get help from my spiritual group. I'd call up one of the people in my spiritual group, and then we'd get the light to come in and, you know, get their helpers to come in and help them away, because it was very it would even give you a little bit of a headache. So it is true that that a lot of people, especially after traumatic death, don't even realize that they're dead, which is
not as much
very interesting
change in the emotional and mental operations. What we find in the program Lifeline up in Monroe, which is their soul rescue program, if you will. Huge variety again from people who might be in a hospital and say, what took you so long? They experience you as like an angelic helper, and they're just ready to go, to folks who, I can't be dead, I'm too young, or whatever it might be.
Right.
But usually once you get their attention away from some kind of looping thinking, then they're able to perceive their own angels, guides, helpers, etc., and loved ones on the other side, and things can progress pretty smoothly if it's just been, you know, an unexpected death for them.
The bad ones are the belief systems that they're going to go to hell, you know,
yeah,
the ones that actually avoid any beings of light because they're so concerned about what's going to happen to them next.
There can be that. In one of the first Lifeline programs, I remember a woman coming across sort of a nondescript energy, but it felt conscious to some extent, and she breathed a lot of love and light into it, and it turned into her dad, who died many years before. And she said, "Dad, haven't you seen angels and all?" I said, "Yeah, but I'm hiding. I don't want to go to judgment." And so, yeah, there can be very deep emotional patterns or belief patterns can get in the way of a smooth transition. I'd like, Susan, to kind of potentially reduce fear. When I wrote the first book, Brothers Forever, I did some statistics on how many people die every day and across the planet. You know, just suicides alone, I think, are one every 4 seconds.
Wow.
So probably a good assumption might be that 99% of people pass very easily, even if they've had some pretty strong beliefs. They're able to understand they've gone, connect with who they need to connect with, and it's probably quite a minority only that have some difficulty. I had another brother die of an ALS type of disease, and we held him as he was transitioning. And he was a very staunch Catholic, but after he died, one of the first messages he sent is, "Joe, you were right," because I'd been talking to him about maybe there is less judgment over there than you might fear.
St. Peter didn't appear at the pearly gates, huh?
No, did not for him. If St. Peter came, he was okay with that. But I think he mainly, we gave him such energy as he died that the feedback we were getting is that helped him along in his journey by a few months, kind of recovering from the physical gruelingness of his passing. And that he immediately saw a family like my brother Pete, who had passed many years before, just to help him over there.
Yeah, that's pretty common. That's pretty common. All the near-death experiences, see their deceased relatives, you know, waiting for them. Sometimes they are not real happy when they're told they have to come back, though.
I've had two of those myself, and the first was a motorcycle accident, and as the body was flopping in the street, a being of light came and talked me into going back. But in later meditations, many years later, I realized that was kind of almost my future self coming back in meditation, saying, "Hey, we got still got stuff to do here.
Work to do, get back in that body."
Yeah.
That's true. Well, tell us a little bit about the Monroe Institute's Soul Rescue plan, the training.
Well, again, it's a graduate program there. They, you know, have you go through their introductory program, which is called Gateway, which was one of the most profound weeks of my life. I really loved it. And back as Bob Monroe's wife was getting near her transition, and in his meditations, he would be coming across scenes where it seemed like soldiers were fighting and hadn't realized they had passed on yet. Those kind of things. He developed this Lifeline program. So it uses this brainwave technology, and you're introduced to higher levels, sort of a bridge state between here and there, up into area where we could call dissociated consciousness, where people may be heavy drug state, coma, Alzheimer's, still have a body, but they're very removed from here, to an area we could call new goners or newcomers, where people have dropped the body and they may not be aware they have. Then into some belief system areas, for want of a better word, like, you know, if you believe strongly in a happy hunting ground, you might see something like that. And then into what they call Focus 27, an area that was called the park. And there it seemed designed for human beings to really be able to relax after a life, feel very oriented, safe, secure, meet with other loved ones and guides, plan for next life, do healing there between lives, those kinds of things. So in the Lifeline program, folks would be trained to go up into that 27 park area, form a good base camp there, if you will, so they could get there easily, pick up guides and helpers and go back to that state of new goners, newcomers. And if you're a knower, you would, like you said, just know somebody's behind you or in front of you, and telepathically you could pick up their name. If you're a seer, you might see them. And in fact, the show called The Unexplained on TV, forget the network, Learning Channel maybe, did a show on the Lifeline program. And after it, they went in Library Congress or archives and were able to document some of these souls that were picked up even from the 1800s in terms of the data that the meditator had gathered on them. So it was pretty interesting. It sounds like it could be a gruesome program because you're meeting people in their death scene often is what you see. But you also get to experience the reunion that they have with loved ones and guides. And there's so much love and joy flowing in those that the program actually is quite gleeful. And people, when they started doing that, this was the mission as I've just described, but they also found they were retrieving parts of themselves, even from this life. Like, say, Susan, if you were in third grade and you were coloring vigorously and the teacher came by and said, you're not staying within the lines, you'll never be an artist, and you shut down your artistic ability, folks going through Lifeline seem to reclaim even lost parts of themselves from this life, if you will. So it's a kind of a neat program.
Yeah, it sounds like it is. Very helpful. Mm-hmm. So let's talk a little bit about the idea that in a future society we might have assisted suicide. You know, in some states this is being considered, obviously for terminally ill people or people in a lot of pain. That have no other treatment options. What do you feel about that?
Very much needs to be, case by case. The feedback I was getting on this book, if, say, you did have just a short while left to live and you decided to avoid the pain at the end, that might take you a couple hours on the other side of no time to dust off from that, if you will. I always come back to, I've had so many animals in my life now, I'm 67, that I've dearly loved, and I've had to assist some of them to leave because they were unable to do so themselves and were in condition that they could not recover from. And I always wonder, as a society, when we'll be as compassionate to humans as we are to our beloved animals. I know with humans, you know, it's very complex. My brother, who died of, like, ALS type of disease, he was saying, Joe, you know, it's a slippery slope because the person dying might feel guilty about all the money that's being spent on their medical care or, you know, blah, blah, blah. And it's very hard to have this completely clean without it being an ethical slippery slope. I still think it should be an option for people, but needs to be done in a very conscious way in terms of conscious of soul issues, conscious of whether it's ego or spirit operating on this. I think it would be good to have that option. And the way it's set up now is pretty good, where they do allow. There are pretty extensive panels you have to go through, counseling you have to go through. And so people are attempting to build in knowing this is a very serious decision, build in safeguards.
But especially for people being coerced by relatives to do that, that would be a big danger.
You know, you'd be depressed and not be really thinking very well, and if they got their proper medications, you might feel differently.
Right.
I think one of the biggest things that can be implemented if the person has the time is just say, you know, go through this whole thing, and then, you know, there's a 60-day waiting period or whatever with a couple more contacts to see if maybe the person begins to change their mind. But
yeah.
I don't see it as a horrible tragedy sometimes in conditions where people have been suffering to that degree and they don't have much time left and we don't seem to be able to do much to relieve their suffering.
I'll tell you something about hospice that's interesting. Have you had people in hospice close to you ever?
My brother that I mentioned with ALS had the in-home hospice, and as my work as a psychologist, had hospice familiarity, if you will.
Just about every hospice patient has morphine,
mm-hmm.
and just about any hospice patient has the ability to take an overdose of morphine.
Okay.
It just is what it is. I mean... It's not
That's
monitored.
How we handle things informally now.
Well, I mean, I just noticed that. I mean, I'm a physician, obviously, and I've had two parents go through hospice, and it was very clear to me that if somebody wanted to kill themselves, it would be very easy for them to do so.
If they were able to physically.
Well, in cancer, you're able to, most likely.
Yeah.
I mean, other than
yeah.
if you're unconscious or something from brain meds, but you're definitely able to. I mean,
mm-hmm.
it's not... And even if you can't get out of bed, you can probably reach over to your nightstand and grab the morphine, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just something that I bet it happens a lot more than we know.
Oh, yeah. Well, the whole thing, suicide right now is an epidemic. Europe is really aggressively looking at this to provide preventive care and then help for the relatives after they went. I have a web person that works for me, and he spends half a year in Ireland and half a year here. So he was being exposed to all that over there, and he came back here to try to see what's going on in the United States, and he couldn't even find good statistics. You know, the sum that we do have show a very dramatic rise, but as you know, as a physician, you know, a person may overdose on pills, but the cause of death listed is heart attack, cardiac arrest. And so we don't even have a good idea how much of that's going on. And when you get into the euthanasia area, you know, then a lot is done in, I think, a very compassionate way. You know, when my brother with ALS, he lost ability to swallow and breathe and all of that. And on the one day, about 2 weeks before, I'd asked him every day, you know, still want to continue? Oh, yeah, I look forward to getting up even with all my problems. About 2 weeks before his death, he said, you know, I'm tired now, and began to make some final arrangements. Mm-hmm. And then the day he died, we were over there, and the nurse and I think an actual doctor came to his house as well, said, John, to clear your throat now, we'd have to intubate you way, way down. Do you want us to do that? And he shook his head no. And they gave him some morphine. My suspicion is a little more than they usually gave him. Mm-hmm. And he went to sleep and then didn't wake up in the 2 hours after.
Let me tell you why this is important. A lot of insurance companies for health insurance as well as life insurance don't give you benefits if there's a suicide.
At least
for
2 years.
You're aware of that, right?
Yeah. Yeah. My brother had to, and most policies say you cannot commit suicide within 2 years of your taking the policy out. Yeah.
And was he after 2 years? Is that how it works?
Yeah.
So, you know, he was a planner, though, obviously. He was a big planner.
Yeah,
he planned a lot of things. So, I was wondering when I read the book how they got, you know, he got around that clause, because that is almost in all policies.
Yeah, no, he died 5 years ago. I don't know current policies if they read the same, but at that time it was fairly usual to just have a wait period like that.
Right. So, you know, basically, you know, without the proper planning, suicide or suicide attempts can be very, very costly to the family, you know, and to the person. So
yeah,
people
right.
need to
they're always that. Costly, but financially,
financially costly, where they don't realize it. You know, I think a lot of people don't realize these clauses are in there. I mean, who reads their contracts, right? I mean, they just don't. So. But it's interesting.
Yeah.
Well, we're coming up on the end of our hour. Would you like to give your contact information?
Yeah, that would be great. If people are interested in the book, Heaven is for Healing, it's on Amazon. And if you go to heavenisforhealing.com, you'd go to my website. And the books I sent from my site are signed. And we also have lots of these meditation CDs that I've mentioned, including one I put out with the book called Ocean Heart, to help people that have had a deeply broken heart through loss or betrayal or a relative committing suicide, those kind of things, to be able to help people in that kind of deep pain heal very easily or heal more easily. And so that's called Ocean Heart, and you can see that on the website as well. So heavenisforhealing.com will take you there.
Great. And do you have any words of wisdom for the listening audience about this substance? What have you learned having gone through this, and what can you tell them if they have a similar type of loss?
First would be, it can be take a tremendous amount of time. You know, society says 1 year and you should be over it, throw away the black, start dating again, what have you. As you mentioned, death of a child, death by suicide, what have you, grief takes its own course, but you're wanting to look that you might go round and round and up and down, but that you're making some progress over the months, and if not, to get some help that way. That, I think, is important. And also to convey, you know, if you've lost a loved one and they're on the other side, and they're being held with the greatest of love and worked with, and that they are not in some kind of hellish torment for eternity. That I would like to convey.
And that we all, you know, have a chance to try again. You know, the ancient Aramaic term sin was an archery term meaning to miss the mark.
Yes.
So nobody can really ever, commit a sin that is irreversible. You just get to try again.
I would agree. The way they put it, at least in the contacts I had on the other side through this book, was a soul does have to learn how to hold at least a thimble full of light before moving into another incarnation. But most are able to do that. You know, there are very heavy murder-suicide situations and things that they said may even take hundreds of years to clear in Earth time. There's no time over there, so it doesn't matter in some ways. But, there's potential for help for everybody over there.
Great. Well, thank you so much for the interview.
Sure, Susan, my pleasure.
We've been speaking.
Sorry.
Go ahead, Joseph.
I just said I hope it helps a lot of folks today. Our conversation.
Oh, I'm sure it will. We've been interviewing Joseph Gallenberger. His newest book, Heaven is for Healing: A Soul's Journey After Suicide. And next week we will have on Ken Roha, Staying Healthy in an Era of Biowarfare, GMOs, and Geoengineering. Thank you so much for joining us at Temple of Health Radio Show.